to you from the West Coast. This is Politicoast. May the 4th be with you. This is episode 32. Politicoast is a podcast that explores what's happening in British Columbia and across the country. If you haven't already, make sure to subscribe and leave us a review on iTunes or wherever tolerable podcasts are found. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter where we're at PoliticoastPod.
I'm Scott.
And I'm Ian. Quick reminder, which will only be worth listening to if you download and listen to this before Tuesday. And actually, this entire episode is really time sensitive because there's an election on Tuesday, if you didn't know. But on Tuesday night, we're hosting an election night party at Jaeger's on Pender Street in downtown Vancouver. You can join us there after 7 p.m. and we'll even try and do a live recording. It might go on Facebook Live. It might not. We don't know. We'll figure it out. Polls are closing at 8 p.m. We'll probably do some talking around then, just predicting what'll happen again. And then some further discussion once we have final results coming in probably between 10 and 11. Try and RSVP on our Facebook page if you can at facebook.com/politicoast, or just let us know on Twitter that you're coming. It's not that you have to RSVP. We just want to know that we're not going to be sitting there drinking by ourselves. And if some other people do come and we have some fun, we'll do this more often. So let us know if you want to have Politicoast pub nights, and it will be a thing. So let's jump in. An election too close to call. The election's coming up on Tuesday, as we mentioned. And to sort of get in the spirit of thinking about the polls and the data and the analysis and figuring out who's going to win, we sat down with Brian from Too Close to Call, actually like an hour ago, and talked to him about his website, which is one of those sort of Nate Silver-esque prediction websites. So take it away, Brian.
So my name is Brian Brugge. I'm the guy behind the website Too Close to Call. I do electoral projections for mostly Canadian elections and politics.
And what's your background outside of running a little niche website?
I have a bachelor in political science and economics. I have a master in economics, and I studied the PhD in economics, but I didn't finish it.
All right, so before we jump into specifics and things, maybe just give us your general take on how do you come up with a projection? Like, what's your process behind the scenes without the, like, nitty-gritty of the mathematics?
Sure. Mostly it's a function of two things. The results last time around plus the polls this time. So it's really, you know, you take the result last time, you add or subtract the swing we can observe with the polls, and that's pretty much it.
So what are your thoughts on kind of how the election's gone so far and what you're watching for as the final polls are coming out?
Well, I think it's incredibly close. I mean, I've been doing this website since 2011. I don't think I've ever seen an election this close. I mean, and this close to the election night. It's almost a 50-50 race at this point. And in terms of dynamics, we didn't see any big trend, any big changes during the campaign. To be fair, we didn't have many polls either. I think I see a slightly different trend since the debate. I think up to the debate, it was pretty positive for the NDP, and I'm of the opinion that the debate wasn't a good event for John Horgan and the NDP, and we have seen a different trend after the debate. We have seen polls all, you know, the Liberals are up. In some polls, the Liberals are even first now, so we wouldn't see this before.
We saw maybe a bit of a trend in the 2013 election, but even the polls released a couple days before the election were showing, you know, a 5-10 point lead maybe for the NDP. And so it was kind of the black eye for the polling industry when the Liberals won a majority. Do you think that's caused them to be afraid of this election?
Oh, yes. And I think we have example. There was an article in the Globe and Mail where literally some pollsters openly admitted they don't want to touch the BC election because it's too risky. So now we see it. We see major firms, Ecos hasn't published anything. Abacus hasn't published anything. And we rely mostly, the only one who has consistently polled is Main Street Research. All the other ones. And this morning we've got one from Angus Reid. And notice the timing. They made sure to publish it early enough that if they're wrong, they can always find an excuse. But late enough that if they're right, they can claim victory. So it's right. Strategic there.
Why do you think the polls didn't get it right last time and there's that big error?
I really wish I knew. I mean, and I look into it. Many people have. I managed to get the data from Abacus, from David Coletto. He sent me the detailed data from the last poll. And there is nothing. I mean, I really don't know what happened there. Some people have argued that it was a question of the weight by age. People in BC tend to be older when they vote, or the demographic is really skewed older. Like, I think half the voters last time were 50 and plus. So, you know, if you weight based on the census and not based on the voters, that doesn't make sense. But, you know, they were doing the same thing in 2009, and the NDP was underestimated in 2009. So I'm not sure. I really wish I knew. The only explanation I might have is that was the time where they were all experimenting with online polling, with likely voter models, and they have moved away from this. And they haven't done mistakes. They have been pretty good ever since. So we're just crossing our fingers at this point.
Yeah, I remember watching the polls in the 2015 Alberta election, and no one believed those because there had been the mistakes and the misses on the other elections, and they were showing the Alberta NDP taking 40% of the vote, and everyone's like, no, that'll never happen. And then it happened, and as far as I remember, it was actually like the pollsters nailed it for a change.
I wouldn't say this. What actually... They underestimated the PC, the Conservative, by 5 or 6 points again. So it did happen again last time in Alberta. I think this time we never noticed because, you know, who was supposed to win did win. It's the same as in the last federal election. Mm-hmm. Everybody the next day was like, oh, congratulations to the pollsters and whatnot. But I disagree with this. I think their polls were pretty wrong in Quebec. They were wrong in Atlantic Canada. And systematically, they were underestimating the Liberals by 1 to 2 points. It's just that, you know, you focus on the one or two polls that were right, and you're like, oh, see, they had it.
So there have been issues with the past BC election, with the federal election, as you just mentioned. The American election of last year was another one. How confident should people be in polling and models such as yours that work off polling data?
So if you look historically over the last 10 years in Canada, margin of errors, you should go with like about between 4, 5, and 6 points. 6 when we have bad elections, 3 to 4 when we have more accuracy. So it really, well, you know, right now we have two parties pretty much tied at 40%. So we can have 43-37 or vice versa. So it does create a lot of uncertainty. This is why, you know, I've started doing those simulations and have the probabilities, because I think this represents more what we can say and what we can't. Obviously, people focus on the top line numbers and they see the number of seats, but they should really look at the probabilities.
Yeah, I noticed Eric Grenier at 308 started doing that, sort of giving ranges instead of like the, you know, solid prediction number, that most likely one, just as a way to almost buffer against that sort of 95-80% confidence levels. That's still tough because you still want to go, well, who's going to win? And you're just telling us it's going to be a coin flip.
Yes, and not only this, you know, then people come to your website and they tell you you're pretty useless. If on Monday I say it's a 50-50 election, they're going to tell me, bravo, why are you even doing all those calculations? But, you know, sometimes knowing that you don't know is already significant. So I think sometimes it's important to at least represent this uncertainty. The U.S. election, it was a perfect example of this. We had pundits, we had, you know, advanced analysis showing, like, Hillary Clinton with like 99.9% of winning. And I was like, that doesn't make sense. All she needs to lose, or all Donald Trump needs to win, is a swing in like 2 points. By Canadian standards, the polls being wrong by 2 points, that's a good night. I'm going to be happy if on Tuesday they're only off by 2 points. So it didn't make sense to me to only give Donald Trump like less than 1% chance.
For sure. Coming back to BC, this election, one of the big topics has been sort of the rise of the Green Party, and just, you know, we've seen polls with them at 20%+ province-wide, couple polls with them in the lead on Vancouver Island. How do you think polls deal with sort of these surgent third parties?
Oh, I think they don't do a good job. I don't do a good job. It's really difficult to predict what will happen. Usually, historically, when you have a party surging like it's happening for the Green Party, surprises will happen. They might be very high in ridings we never thought they would be high. They might win more riding than I'm predicting right now. Plus, the Green Party is tricky this time because one of the reasons they increased, or one of the reasons they might have increased, is they're running more candidates. So the simple fact that they're running about, 24-23 more candidates than last time, this alone will make them increase in the vote shares. So I mean, if we have to try to take that into account, and for the Green in particular, the big question is how concentrated their support is around Victoria on Vancouver Island. If they manage to get like most of their support there, they could go and get like 6, 7, 8 seats. The entire island could be pretty much all green. On the other hand, if they're unlucky and they get like 20% everywhere, they're going to be hit by the electoral system like really, really hard and pretty much get 2, 3 seats.
Speaking of seats, one of the things that's come up quite a bit recently is the questions of strategic voting and trying to figure out at a riding level where you should place your vote if you want a particular outcome. How confident should people be in kind of the polling numbers that do come out and trying to make those guesses on where they should vote?
Oh, I don't think they should be. I mean, I've been against strategic voting. I'm not against the principle of strategic voting. If people want to vote this way, go for it. I mean, you vote for whatever reason you want. I'm against like organization like LIDNA, right? Or what was the Fair Vote last time, where they try to literally run campaign telling people who to vote for. I think this is misguided. We don't have the accuracy necessary to do this. We have very few writings where really clearly we could tell you there is vote splitting there and you should vote one way or the other. So it's really, if yourself you want to come to my side, go to the CBC website and decide to vote strategically, go for it. I mean, I'm perfectly fine with this. But be just remember that not only we make mistakes, and realize that the chances of your actions really having any effect are very small.
Do we have actually any data on what percentage of voters are voting strategically when they go to the polls?
Yes, and I think there was a literature about this, academic literature. It's usually pretty small. I mean, people overestimate how many people vote strategically. I think, you know, in recent years, it has become like a trend, or a lot of people were saying, oh, I vote strategically. I don't know why. I think some people think it makes them look smarter to pretend that they want to do this. But, you know, as I said, not only you have to decide to vote strategically, then you need to know how to do it. So as glad, you know, I'm glad if those people come on my side, but I don't think they all do. I don't think everybody goes on Eric Grenier's side on the CBC or anything. So I think people overestimate. If you simply do a poll and ask them, are you considering voting strategically? I think people will say yes, just because it looks good. But empirically, I don't think that many people do. I think there was one from Andrew Blair from the University of Montreal a couple of years ago, and it was finding around, I might be wrong, but something like 5% of the voters who were doing it. That might have increased in recent years with the rise of data, the internet, websites like mine. But I still don't think max 10 or 15%. And even there, I think we're most likely overestimating. And not only are we overestimating what happens, realize that some people might just do the wrong thing. There might be liberals who vote NDP and vice versa, and they just cancel out in a riding. So the net effect, I look at the election in 2015 when you had those organizations, they had targeted, 30 ridings, 35, and I could not find a single significant, there was no significant, statistically speaking, effect of their campaign.
Well, and they had a significant number of misses where they said vote Liberal and the NDP won, or vice versa.
Exactly. So misses, because they were not forcing the Liberals being so high. We have one example here. Vancouver Granville was a complete fiasco for them. And then, you know, then after that, they like to look at the results and be like, see, the Liberal won. This is thanks to us. And like, no, they would have won even if you didn't do anything. So that's not because of you. So it's really difficult to, and it's difficult to prove that this had an impact. And to stay on strategic voting, right now the talk would be about the green voters, right? I mean, how will do they split the vote? Do they want to go for the NDP at the last minute? But we don't really talk about the strategic voting for the Liberals. I mean, let's take the riding of Victoria Beacon Hill, the one of Carol James. If I'm a Liberal voter and I want Christy Clark to remain premier, if I live in Victoria, I would vote for the Green because they have a better chance of winning those seats than the NDP.
I think that highlights, like you're talking about the BC Liberal sort of strategic vote, they've always sort of been this coalition of the anti-NDP, let's call it. And one of the problems with this election has been, and that we've commented frequently on, is this ghost BC Conservative support that's been as high as 10% when now they're running 10 candidates, which there's no way they're going to get all of the 10% of support in those ridings. So maybe you could talk about some of the problems, because I know you had a problem with Forum specifically on this issue.
Oh, yes. And you know, we have many reasons to not be confident for Tuesday. I think what happened to the BC Conservative is one of the main reasons. So not only we have a party that got 5% last time, that will be lucky to get one this time, and it's not going to be because it's a party, it's because we have 10 candidates. We have a couple of ridings where they got like 10, 15% last time. What happens to those votes in those ridings? I mean, I try to find, you know, correlation or anything related to the increase of the BC Conservative, because most people assume, you know, if you vote Conservative, you would vote Liberals, as you just said. But my numbers do not suggest this. I mean, I see many ridings where they hurt the NDP more than the Liberals. It really depends. It's almost random at some point. I couldn't find any pattern or trend. And yes, now we still have polls. We had the Forum one. We still included the BC Conservative at 7%, I believe. This afternoon, we had the new Innovative poll with the BC Conservative at 7% as well. So, you know, it's really interesting to think that a party that doesn't exist can poll at 7%. Think about it. There are so many small parties around Canada that have been working super hard for many, many years, and they exist. They do have candidates, and they cannot break 3, 4, 5%. And you have this party that doesn't exist and that poll at 7, 8, or 9%. This is really funny, and it will have an impact. The problem for me or for pollsters is we don't know in which direction. The only guess I could go with right now is it might decrease the turnout. I think we saw in 2013 that in ridings where the Conservative increased a lot, it did increase the turnout. So those people might just stay home.
Speaking of turnout, one of the things that often comes up with kind of surging parties is getting people out who didn't vote before. And it's not so much a swing vote as a new vote. How do your models take that into account, and will that likely change the Greens' prospects?
So for the question about my model, the answer is very simple. It doesn't, and I don't know any model in Canada who actually takes into account of the turnout. I'm trying this time because I think that was one of the reasons I was wrong in 2015. So what I'm doing right now is I'm trying to look at advanced turnout to see if I can find any pattern, any region that seems to be more volatile. And in particular, as you mentioned, if the Green is surging, I would expect a higher turnout on Vancouver Island. So far, after the first 2 days, it's not obvious that we see this. The only trend I managed to find was Surrey. A lot of Surrey ridings look to be having a higher turnout than last time. But after that, who will benefit from this? I mean, the fact that outside of the Green Party, and we don't expect the Green to win in Surrey or Delta, I'm not sure who benefits from it. I mean, the other two parties are mostly where they were 4 years ago. You don't have a big swing. So it might be simply a question of getting the vote out. And at this game, I don't know who wins, especially not in those ridings.
Yeah, I can definitely see that in Surrey, where there are a lot of swing ridings there, and therefore the parties are putting a lot of their GOTV resources there.
Oh, and we see the NDP in particular, this election, they've been targeting the lower mainland so much. I mean, this is John Horgan is really hoping to win all those ridings they lost by like 5-6% last time. So we talk about 2 or 3 in Surrey, 1 in Port Coquitlam, 1 or 2 in Vancouver. So, but, you know, that works from the side of the NDP. You expect the Liberals to defend those ridings and to be aware of this. They have a lot of data. They know how to get the vote out. So maybe it's just a wash and it's just more votes splitting between the two.
Coming back to the advanced voting, we've seen a couple days already, so we have the data. Elections BC is kind enough to put it all on open data, which is fantastic. But it's also, we have more advanced voting this year. I think we have twice as many days. How are you looking at that?
So obviously we're going to have a much better idea after Saturday when advanced voting is over. So far after the first 2 days, what I've tried to do in order to make the data compatible with last time was I pretty much compared the turnout in each riding to the average. And so this is how I could see that the Surrey ridings were increasing compared to, they were below average last time or slightly above average. They're really above average this time around. Beyond this, I don't know. And, you know, BC election was talking about a record turnout for the first 2 days, but exactly it's not directly comparable. We have more days this time. Plus, you know, if you look over the last 10 years in every province in Canada or every federal election as well, advanced turnout has increased on its own. So just because we get a higher advanced turnout by Saturday doesn't mean it might just be a displacement of voters from Tuesday to Saturday. So I would say, what was last time? 12% of the voters?
I think so. That sounds right.
So I would say if it's around like 14 or 15, that would pretty mean that the turnout will be the same as last time overall.
I know on your site you've looked at a couple other metrics besides just the polls. Maybe you could talk about sort of the Google trends you've looked at and anything else that you've tried to, you know, read the tea leaves of the election and whether any of those actually worked before.
I'm trying to not be as dependent on the polls, just so that, you know, it's a safety issue for me, right? So, yeah, I'm using Google Trends to see, you know, which party and which leader people Google it, because it worked pretty well for the 2015 federal election. Somebody like John Kirby, right, I think had like literally the election nailed with seats using Google Trends. We have literature about this, that it works sometimes, it doesn't work other elections. I think it's just a question of maybe seeing if there is something fundamentally different if we use other metrics. So with Google Trend, we see a close race. Liberals slightly ahead if you take the last 30 days. NDP slightly ahead if you focus on the last 4 or 5 days. I think it was mostly useful like after the debate. After the debate, we saw a surge in Andrew Weaver searches. And I think this was a strong indication that he most likely won the debate, relatively speaking. So if you look at the parties, close race, if you look at the leaders, Kristi Clark is winning easily. She's really, really popular. She's really, really well-known, something that is hurting John Horgan. Right now, what I'm trying to do is I've been collecting the social media numbers of each candidate. So I go in each candidate in each riding, and I look on their Twitter or Facebook account, how many people are following them. Obviously, there is a bias for the incumbent. I mean, if you have been minister for like 4 years, you have your Twitter is much more popular. But that might be interesting. I noticed some trends, some numbers were funny. Like a lot of candidates have no such social campaign at all.
Right.
Especially in the interior of BC. We have many NDP candidates who don't even have a Facebook page. Like literally when you click on their Facebook logo, it brings you to John Horgan's or the NDP. So surprisingly, for instance, we have reason to believe that the Green are doing really well in Kamloops. And if you look at the social media number, I believe it. I think the NDP isn't there. They're not even trying. And the opposition will go with the Green. So will I use this for my projections? It's a risky move. It's new. It's not tested. At the same time, you know, I mean, I'm wrong half the time, so I might as well try new things sometimes. It might not hurt.
Do you have any theory on why someone isn't setting up a Facebook or Twitter account? The resources are so low on that. You think it would just be one of those things you do when you file your nomination papers?
I think it's a sign that those campaigns do not exist. I mean, sure, they have a candidate in those ridings, but they don't compete. They have no money there. They have no organization. And this is most likely what happens because, as you said, if you just run a normal campaign, even as an independent candidate, you should have at least a couple of hundred people following you. That doesn't make sense if you don't. So I think that's actually a nice way to look at for the non-existing campaigns out there and who is not even challenging for each seat.
What areas are you going to be looking at on election night?
So I think it's mostly two areas. Most of the interior of British Columbia will be pretty boring. I have a feeling the Liberals are even higher than last time, so they might pretty much win everything out there, except maybe in the east. No, it's really two regions. It's the lower mainland, the suburb. So I'm talking Surrey, Port Coquitlam. One or two ridings in Vancouver proper. I mean, Fraser View, Langham, Burnaby North should be a close race. That's one of the few Liberal seats. I'm pretty sure they want to keep it. Richmond, most likely not. There might be one, but it would be a really, really big surprise. I would say if the NDP wins a riding in Richmond, they're winning a majority. I mean, it's going to be a landslide win for them. Otherwise, I think the real battleground this time is this is the island. Everywhere around Victoria, those are the ridings where it can be a three-way race with the Green. And not only this is where the ridings are disputed, this is where the election could be decided, because if the Green Party does better than expected, if they win 6 ridings instead of 3, those 3 seats will come from the NDP. That's almost guaranteed. And so 3 seats from the NDP when it's a close election, that might honestly mean the difference between a Liberal minority and an NDP minority. So, and you know, I look at my simulations, there is no correlation between the Green number of seats and the Liberals. I mean, it's just 2 straight lines. But there is a strong correlation or negative between NDP and Green. Not in terms of votes, in terms of seats. This is where they affect each other.
Do you see any chance for any independents or other parties to go? I know there's one campaign, I think, in Peace River up north.
Yes, I mean, they have even three, including one that might be bigger, that has the same campaign manager, I think, as the previous independent. I think it's still a safe Liberal seat. Otherwise, there is Delta South, where Vicky was elected twice before, and the new independent guy has the support officially of the incumbent. But even there, if you look at the riding, if you look historically, unless the new independent can keep like 100% of the vote, that's a safe Liberal riding. Right. So I get emails like, why don't you have independent? The reason is most of the time it doesn't matter. And honestly, it's a guess. I mean, it's literally a guess. I cannot do better. I might try to use the Twitter number of followers, but beyond this, you know, and we've talked about polls. We haven't had a single riding poll this entire campaign. Oh, no, that's not true. We got one with like 200 observations in Kamloops or something like this that had the communist candidate, a 12%. So, you know, do whatever you want with those numbers.
The revolution is coming in Kamloops.
Yes. There was a communist surge in the interior of British Columbia. So I wish we had. Last time around, Main Street said that the reason they could predict a Liberal majority because they did those riding polls and they prefer riding polls. Usually what Main Street likes to do is they like to focus on one or two ridings that they think are like pretty much, you know, like the representative of BC, and they poll this riding over and over and over again. And this time they might have done it. They haven't published anything. So it's really annoying. We haven't been able to compare our projections to anything more, you know, closer to the riding level, closer to the voters directly.
Do you think hashtag I am Linda had any effect? Perhaps that's why people have been Googling Christy Clark this last week.
I'm trying to be non-partisan there, but the coverage this issue has received is crazy to me. I mean, we spent like a week on this. I don't think it interests anybody outside of social media. I think the coverage, somebody on Twitter, on Facebook was telling me, well, you know, it's good that we didn't get polls this election because instead of always talking about you guys and the numbers, we talk about the real issues. And I was like, that's not true. Instead of talking about my site or Eric's site or anything, we talk about I am Linda. We talk about like, oh, is John Horgan mean or not doing the debate? We spent so much time on those, like, I would call non-issue. I mean, we didn't talk about the minimum wage. We didn't talk about the $10 daycare, barely. We barely talk about most of the policies out there, and we spend so much time focusing on, is she nice to a random voter in a grocery store? So, I don't know. I mean, on social media, it's really negative for Christy Clark. I'm not sure this is the case everywhere, and I almost wonder if this type of controversies do not motivate some voters, some older voters, like, you know, shy liberals or conservative voters to be like, that's enough, we're still going to go vote for Christy Clark.
We have tried to talk about other issues on our podcast, at least. But, like, a lot of the Canadian politics podcasts I've listened to, and there aren't that many, but the, like, non-BC ones, the, like, one thing they've picked up in the last week of BC politics is, like, I am Linda's this thing, and let's talk about that. Like, how has this made it so big? I saw it at first, and I think I was like you. I was like, oh, this is just, like, a little Twitter thing. But I think it was another one of those cases where Christy Clark just kind of dug her own hole by just doing a couple of the wrong things, and then it just got partisan on Twitter, and then journalists need something to talk about. They chose to talk about that instead of tolls and polls.
Oh, I agree. I think Christy Clark reacted really well at the grocery store. She reacted very badly after. I mean, she pretty much lied about the incident. She lied about, and they tried to pretend that Linda was like from the NDP instead of just moving on. I was very surprised. Because, you know, you don't expect this from the BC Liberals. They're very professional in how they run their campaign. I thought they would just... And they remain on message, like, during the entire campaign. I mean, look at the debate. She said jobs, jobs, and jobs to every single question she was asked, which, you know, might seem stupid, but every academic paper about this will tell you need to stay on message, and this is how you win elections. So I was surprised that they managed to get distracted by this I am Linda. I think it's not going to have an impact because it happened early enough. If it was this weekend, maybe. But by now, we're back on track for the BC Liberals.
All right. Well, if there's nothing else you want to get in, and feel free to ad-lib as much as you want, where just remind people where they can find you if they want to get your final projections.
So my final projections will be on tooclosetocall.ca. I will be, if you speak French, I will do the election night with the CBC Vancouver on Facebook Live. Otherwise, you know, on Twitter, Too Close to Call as well. And I have a Facebook page, but I don't do much there. If you want to reach me, the Twitter account is the best way to do so.
All right. Thank you very much, Brian.
Well, thank you for having me.
Well, that's kind of where the state of the polls are at the moment. Let's jump into some of the other topics about the election. First off, I Am Lindo's been trending this week.
Yeah, so we talked about this a bit with Brian, but like we sort of talked with him, it's one of those stories I don't think anyone really expected to become a story. And I sort of share his frustration that why aren't we talking about actual issues? But I think I disagreed with him when he sort of said Christy Clark handled it fine initially. Let's just roll back and say what actually happened in case someone hasn't heard about it, but it's been covered almost everywhere. Christy Clark goes into this grocery store on the Sunshine Coast. This woman, Linda, sees Christy Clark's giant bust outside with her face on it and says, I'm going to give her a piece of my mind. She walks in right up to the premier and goes, Miss Clark, I'm not voting for you. And that's because, and right then Christy Clark jumps in and says, well, that's why we live in a democracy, and then turns her back and walks away. And the comment itself, I think, was fine. It's the sort of, you know, ducking out and just beelining for more positive interactions that sort of initially rub people the wrong way.
Yeah, it's not a great image, but yeah, it's the sort of thing where if you're out on a campaign, you kind of want to get the negative interaction over with quickly and move on to people who, you know, potentially winnable as supporters.
And she probably could have gotten over that initial hiccup, but it was the sort of follow-up of the liberal partisans on Twitter starting to question this woman's motives, not knowing her at all, and suggesting maybe she's an NDP plant, which, even if she was, so what? And their sort of evidence for this was one Facebook photo they dug up. So instantly you have partisan hacks digging through this woman's social media profile to try and find the dirt, which this is the era we live in. Just deal with it. But they found a picture of her with NDP MLA Nicholas Simons, past leadership contender, and just friendly. So I think he met lots of people in the Sunshine Coast. It's a very neighborly community. And so, of course, he took a picture with this woman, and she was proud of it because she's like, oh, he's fun. He's my MLA. I'd get a selfie with Trudeau even if I didn't vote for the guy. So calling her a hack sort of came out of nowhere without a very strong evidence. And then Christy Clark also sort of twisted her words and suggested, oh, she said she'd never vote for me or would never vote BC Liberal. And she said, no, she just said, I'm not voting for you this time.
The kind of overreaction on social media has helped blow this up way out of proportion. And yeah, that's unfortunately the sort of thing that just happens these days. And the hashtag BC Poly is not a nice place. So yeah, it's hardly a surprise this went that way, but yeah, it's just one of those things where it takes a fairly mild interaction and just makes it way worse. And in fact, I think the downsides of social media and the role it plays in campaigns is how it can blow up these rather minor things or exacerbate problems, even if the main campaigns aren't really pushing it. Like, sure, the main NDP campaign doesn't want to be quite as nasty to the Green Party supporters as the NDP supporters on Twitter are, but like it happens and it, you know, just leaves a bad taste in everyone's mouth.
Yeah, the main campaign through, I guess, the TV ads, the thrust of the Liberals in the NDP ads has been excessively negative, sort of attacking them. The Liberals is calling the NDP risky and referring back to the 90s as they want to do. The NDP just going after scandals and corruption in the BC Liberals. And I know the NDP has put out positive ads, sort of the, you know, John Horgan will fight for you kind of thing. He'll use his passion or whatever, but
his rage, one of the two.
Yeah. But you know, he'll go Hulk or whatever. Or most of the ads though that I've seen focused on TV are all the sort of darker, the more attack ads, which in the past, in the last campaign, they didn't use as much. They sort of focused on the positive campaign, and maybe they're swinging the pendulum far the other way, maybe too far.
Yeah, no, I would definitely agree. I think they've gone a little too negative, and we mentioned this after the debate, but I think it goes to the overall campaign message is it's too much of the attack, and it's, you know, we're going to just hammer the Liberals And then, oh yeah, if we get around to it, we might mention our policies. I think the reason it isn't working that well is, like, it's one thing to tell everyone how terrible the liberals are, but if you don't actually have something to offer, then, you know, why would people want to change? You know, it's the devil you know sort of thing. And, like, you need a reason for your supporters to come out to the polls more than just, hey, that other guy's kind of crap.
Well, the NDP and Greens both have fleshed out platforms more so than either of them had in the previous election, where the NDP was simultaneously not running a tax, but also not really presenting a lot. Or when they did sort of talk about pipelines, they sort of flipped halfway through. This time they do have big expensive platforms, which Angus Reid's poll today suggests maybe people are open to. And that's something that I think you're right, that it's hard to talk about. And I wonder if they are trying to talk about it, but it's almost the sort of partisan nature of social media, and even that the media itself is trying to look for what's controversial, because just talking about $10 a day childcare doesn't really stimulate anything. And the strength of the NDP putting forward, and the Greens for that matter, putting forward big expensive platforms, is then the Liberals have to attack it. And when the Liberals attack this sort of tax and spend platform, the NDP can then go, well, of course we have to tax and spend because we want to spend on this, this, and this. And that's sort of their opening. It's a tough line, and I don't know if they've successfully done it this election, but it was at least a chance for them to have talked about their platform.
Yeah, and I feel a little skeptical that they've really managed to drive that point home, because after nearly a month of campaigning, they really haven't budged the polls very much at all. And it's still neck and neck with a party that has been in power 16 years, long list of scandals accumulated, just enough pages that you generally just see these parties not do well and get voted out. And the fact that they haven't been able to kind of build upon their base does indicate they're not being very successful on the communications front.
Well, and that's one thing that's really surprised me. After the election debates, I thought there was enough there that it would sort of start to chip away at Christy Clark, and I thought she didn't do as much as she needed to, but instead it seems to have been sort of the opposite, not in a strong way, but a few more people maybe going back to the BC Liberals and a few trickling away from the others. Everyone sort of stuck around the same, or, you know, that sort of trend. And of course, we're staring at like changes that are within margin of error. So it might be that much bigger changes have happened or nothing has happened. And a lot of the pollsters, as we sort of talked about with Brian, have been so afraid of this province and so afraid of repeating 2013 and the big mistake that they're just not putting themselves out there. So we don't know where the province is.
Yeah, and that's definitely been a problem, is we don't have a huge amount of data to go off of. But what we do have has actually been fairly consistent with minor fluctuations. But the NDP and the Liberals have been hovering around high 30s, low 40s. And the Greens have been 15 to 24. And it's just kind of bounced back around there a little bit. But for the most part, not much has really shifted since the beginning of the election. And that's actually been quite interesting, is that this campaign's almost been a bit of a sleeper, and it just hasn't really seems to have resonated with anybody. Like, you know, the partisans are all super angry at everything, as partisans tend to be, but in terms of your average citizen, I haven't really seen any indication that people are really kind of shifting around too much.
Well, and I think that just goes to show almost the weakness in each of the campaigns, although to their credit, the strength of the Greens. The Greens' biggest risk this entire election was becoming irrelevant, because they're sort of the third party where potentially people just park their votes waiting to see who earned it more. But instead, it sort of solidified there, as Andrew Weber has brought himself forward as a reasonable candidate for at least most. You know, a couple faults, couple, you know, little slip-ups here and there, but overall, generally,
the very least, they've been, any slip-ups of his basically being more or less the same amount as the other ones, so nothing that stands out as being less capable than anyone else. Yeah, they're all playing at the same league.
And so you have the Greens sort of holding at their position and threatening a number of seats on the island, and you have the Liberals and NDP really just trying to plot the map of how they can build a majority coalition out of this province. The Liberals are sort of in the advantage because they're the incumbent government. They have seats galore in the interior, strong presence in the suburbs of Vancouver, and, you know, enough scattering around the other areas that all they need to do is sort of keep the seats they have, whereas the NDP needs to pick up a lot and not lose them to the Greens.
Like we talked about with Brian, it's just there really isn't anything we can really say on how that's going to shake out either, and it's hard to kind of see where we're going to go, and like I'm just kind of at a loss on where things are going to be going. You know, I have, if anything, I might lean towards the prediction I made back when we did our crossover with This Is Lotus Land, but, you know, that's could just as easily be wrong, and, you know, I'm pretty sure you likely feel the same way about your NDP surge prediction.
It's such a toss-up that every little thing could change it in the last few days. One thing that I think I'm wondering about is in the advanced voting numbers we've seen, I think it's been a little bit weaker in some parts of Vancouver Island than I would have expected if the Green surge was going to be real. I'm almost wondering if their get out the vote isn't as strong as perhaps the NDP and the Liberals, who have well-established political machines. Having a machine doesn't matter if you have this big surge of popular will. We've seen that in the sort of federal Liberals potentially in 2015 and the NDP surges in Alberta and in Quebec in 2011, when people who didn't campaign, people who were out of the country the entire campaign, became members of parliament. Even Trump wasn't known to have a very strong electoral machine, but you can still become president, a member of parliament, if there's just sort of the right magic mix of... But I don't feel like that's quite here. The Greens are like on the cusp of it, but still just below the level they'd need.
On the other hand, what... Like, part of the mechanism behind Trump's success was decline in Democratic turnout in a few key swing states. Like, if you look at the numbers, they're fairly consistent for on the Republican side for the last couple of elections, and the Democrats slowly tanked off over between 2008 and 2016. And, you know, you might be seeing a similar thing here. And like I said, we just don't have enough good polling or good enough turnout models to really predict it. But, you know, it's just as likely that the lower advanced turnout may just be that, you know, just fewer people are wanting to vote in an election. Nobody really seems all that keen on anyone for. And in that case, how many people actually do turn out become a major deciding factor. And, you know, if maybe the Greens are surging, but declining turnout on the other parties are making it all look like a wash, or, you know, the opposite should be happening. We just really don't know. And because of that, it's going to be a little hard to say. So, like, there's a chance we're going to have minority with Greens holding the balance of power, which is kind of what I thought might happen at the start of the election. But it's probably more likely we're going to have someone eke out a majority. But, you know, who knows at this point?
So this really highlights the tense neck and neck nature of it. And this all just follows our conversation earlier. And so this is leading to more and more partisanship. So we're seeing talk about strategic voting. We're also seeing this sort of NDP surrogate attack on the Greens and on the Liberals and trying to paint them the same. And then Weaver sort of didn't help himself earlier when he went on Global News and was sort of asked about, if there's a minority, who are you going to support? And he's an honest guy, so I think. So he talked about how he finds John Horgan a bit abrasive and maybe hard to work with at times, and he's generally found Christy Clark to be a friendly, nice person. And he didn't say, yes, I will support her over him. But Global News ran that as a headline.
Which, you know, what the hell were they thinking? Like, this is what kind of one of the narratives that one side's been trying to push, and then to run that as the headline when it isn't true, just, that's, you know, big press fail.
And so when this gets shared on Facebook, it actually sort of kept that first headline because of the way they didn't update their...
The way Facebook's update algorithm updates those.
And so you still had people sort of seeing this, and especially on the sort of NDP side, getting outraged. And in my own view, when I read Weaver's quotes, he sounded a lot more sympathetic to the Liberals than to the Greens, just in at least the persona. You can look at his voting record, and he sides with the NDP far more than he sides with the Liberals.
I think it's more a case of just the personality of the party leaders more than kind of politics or the party platforms, at least in terms of what Weaver was discussing in that quote.
But it sort of highlights the difficult position he's in, because he wants to be a sort of anti-liberal candidate, but he also wants to sort of keep that door open to maybe not forming a coalition in a minority parliament, but just sort of going vote by vote, as we sort of did at the federal level in Canada for a number of years. And that becomes risky. And then again, a third party faces a lot of risk going into a coalition government under First Past the Post. We saw in the United Kingdom, the Liberal Democrats joined a coalition with the Conservatives and ended up breaking one or two sort of promises that were viewed as very core around tuition pledges, and then essentially have been wiped off the potential map in the UK since, wiped down back down to 10% when they were in the 25 to 30% range.
Yeah, I can't see a coalition government forming, but, you know, what could happen if there's a minority is, you know, we've replaced the kingmaker role and, you know, basically decides who gets to be premier and, you know, can basically has a huge amount more influence on the sort of legislation that does go through as a result. And, you know, I think that's one of the reasons why he didn't come out and say, yeah, you know, I'll work with the NDP, is because, you know, you don't show your hand before a negotiation. And I've seen a bunch of people try and spin this one as, oh, you know, he won't rule out working with Christy Clark. Isn't that terrible? But like, on the other hand, would you expect him to say, hey, you might as well vote NDP because that's what you're going to get anyway? Neither option is good, but at least he maintains his independence and reason to be a party if he doesn't pledge ahead of time who he's going to support. You know, if electoral reform is the big one they want to push for rather than political fundraising, which is their other big change they really want to see made, is, you know, they might say, hey, we'll pass your throne speech so you actually get to be the government, but this better be like Bill 2 or we're defeating the next confidence motion, and the NDP can go to the lieutenant governor and say, hey, let us form a government.
Well, it's worth digging into that a little, because that's a very specific situation, and it's one that's almost come up a couple times in Canada, and actually has once or twice. But the official, I think, rule of thumb is that whoever is premier the day before the election gets first dibs at forming government the next day. But typically, if you have less seats, you waive that because you can't.
Yeah, I definitely agree on that. And it's unlikely that Weaver would go, hey, there's the NDP have two more seats, but are still minority. I'm going to try and work with the Liberals on that. Like, I just can't see that happening. But what I could see happening is a Liberal minority trying to play off of that one.
Whoever has the most seats is what's generally become the convention, gets the first dibs at trying to form a government in Canada, even though
technically that isn't how it goes, but yeah, by
technically being the convention, that is just an unwritten rule, and I guess it's sort of changing in Canada.
Yes, and yeah, the practical effect is that the person who was running government who didn't get the highest number of seats will step aside.
And so if the Liberals win the most seats, but not a majority on election night, then Christy Clark will go and say, I'll form a government, just try and run through policy by policy. And if she loses her throne speech, what would usually happen is we'd call an election. But if it's this close to an election, there's a very high chance John Horgan could step in with fewer seats and still say, hey, give me a shot.
Yeah, and there isn't a hard and fast rule on it, but generally the earlier in the mandate, the less likely it is that the lieutenant governor or governor general will decide to go for an election rather than inviting another party to form government.
And all of this is sort of predicated on a not repeat of the 2008 coalition crisis, which happened when Stephen Harper had won a renewed stronger minority, brought in an economic update in November after being elected in October, sort of pretending the fiscal crisis that was obviously happening wasn't happening, and also trying to kneecap the opposition parties in party financing. The Liberals, who Stéphane Dion was leader at the time, but he'd already committed to resigning, and NDP got together, but they didn't actually have enough votes to run a majority, so they said they'd be propped up by the Bloc Québécois. They wrote this letter to try to go to the governor general and say, put us in power. Only before that could really happen, Stephen Harper prorogued parliament. And then we just sort of had a big mess, an almost constitutional crisis, until Michael Ignatieff saved the day by caving to Stephen Harper's next demand.
Yeah, but I can't see that happening here. For one thing, there isn't the toxic factor that the Bloc presented, and like, that's what I think really ended up sinking it, is like, the rest of Canada just would not stomach a government being formed with separatists. Like, it's just one of those things that was a line that, you know, would not be crossed, and there was no way the Liberals and the NDP to make it work where they didn't come out looking like they just sold out Canada.
So let's just really hope that if we want this same situation to repeat, the Cascadia Party or the Vancouver Island Party get some seats in there, or the sort of two quasi-separatists. One wants to separate Vancouver Island into its own province. The other wants BC to join with Washington and Oregon into a new country. They have a couple fringe candidates out there, and realistically zero shot of winning. But if they won, they could be our Bloc Québécois and could hold that balance of power.
I think we could basically rule out a Green NDP Van Island Party coalition.
All right, well, let's bring it back to reality from the hypothetical. I guess to close off our talk of the election, what do you think's going to happen beyond just the sort of overall seat counts that we don't have an honest clue about? Like, what kind of things will you be watching for on election night?
The big ones I'm going to be watching for is basically the Lower Mainland and Vancouver Island. Vancouver Island's really interesting because that's where the Greens had the best shot at pulling out a bunch of seats. Right now, they're projected to win Oak Bay, Gordon Head, which is Weaver's riding, Saanich North and the Islands, which forms part of Elizabeth May's riding, and very likely to go Green. And I believe it's Cowichan is the other one that's likely to go. If any of those don't get picked up by the Greens, or if the Greens are pulling in a bunch of other seats that aren't on that list, that'll be really telling. And in terms of the Lower Mainland, just kind of how it shades out, the NDP is really focused hard here, and if they aren't picking up as many new seats, or if a few of the current NDP ones flip Liberal, you know, that's probably a sign that we're not going to be getting an NDP majority out of it.
Yeah, I think watching what happens in Surrey and Burnaby and North Van, those kind of areas, is going to be telling for if the NDP can take them, it's theirs. Meanwhile, even my riding here, Vancouver Point Grey, if David Eby loses it, which I don't think he will, even in a pretty bad situation, if he loses it, it's sort of game over. But that would be a washout for the NDP. Like you say, the island, the South Island, definitely. Victoria Beacon Hill might actually be really interesting, and not just because I thought Kaelin was an interesting guy and fun to talk with, and because he's friend of the pod, let's say, but because this is sort of like Carol James's strong NDP hold there for a long time. But if the Greens can break through that due to sort of weird splittings and just how it shakes out, like you're saying, it'll show that the strength of the Greens, at least in terms of the anti-established parties trend, and maybe throws up some flags for the NDP establishment about what they need to shift on. I think we're going to see at least one leader resign on election night, assuming we don't have a minority situation. I think a minority is pretty unlikely, just because there's enough seats that I think the Liberals could get a majority, or I think the NDP could not lose so many that they can't get a majority. And so whoever doesn't win out of the NDP and Liberals will resign. I think Andrew Weaver is guaranteed to keep his seat, and I think he's guaranteed to keep his leadership.
Although he did say that this would be his last election of leader if he doesn't gain any more seats. What's going to be interesting is if the NDP manages to just flat out lose this one, like there's a Liberal majority, or even maybe a Liberal minority on this one, is kind of what happens to the NDP at this point. Because, you know, if they can't win now, you know, when can they win? Because they've tried basically everything at this point. They've tried running a super soft, hey, we're just the government and waiting guys, aren't you know, let's not say anything bad or anything. And they've tried the, we're going to hammer them as hard as we possibly can. We've tried the party insiders for the 90s. We've tried the, you know, new guy who doesn't have any connection to that. And like nothing has worked. And I think that's going to maybe lead to some those existential kind of just where the hell are we going as a party? Whereas with the liberals, unless they get more than decimated at this point, I can't see them do anything but go through a leadership race and, you know, do the normal rebuilding that happens after a loss.
Well, the NDP of today has grown back from the sort of two seats they had after the 90s era, sort of when Ujjal Dosanjh ran his election campaign, which was already a sinking ship that he inherited. You know, he tried to turn it around, but it was too late. So they have rebuilt from that sort of who are we stage to people predicting them two elections in a row that they're going to sweep it. I mean, there will be that crisis of faith and all of that kind of stuff. I also lived in Alberta where they had the same government for 40 years and every opposition party basically went through that multiple times as they got wiped off the map or came back. The Liberals are doing it again. The NDP did it a couple times in the 90s and early 2000s until they became government. And then other right-wing parties even popped up. So it's sort of the natural cycle almost of political parties to grow and shrink and rebuild. And we'll only know on Wednesday which stage each of these parties is going to be in.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. It's just the one thing I could sort of see happening is kind of maybe like what happened with the federal NDP, where they actually did not that badly, but, you know, after slowly building up their thing and, you know, really hoping this time is it, they kind of just imploded, kind of, almost, where by all rights, they should be pretty happy with the result. Like, it wasn't what they wanted, but compared to the historical average, that was a pretty good election for them. But, you know, I'm just kind of a little curious if the same thing might happen here, where it's just been so many times of not quite getting it. It might start to hurt them a bit.
I think the
confidence.
I think the difference is Mulcair. There was a lot of sort of the NDP partisans who felt like Mulcair was holding your nose in the hopes you can get government. The sort of like, we don't really like him. He's not really a New Democrat. He was a Quebec Liberal, but he could win. And then he didn't win. And so now it's like, well, let's just go back to our values because selling out doesn't work anyway. And it's just that tension of bitterness. New Democrats think John Horgan's a New Democrat. There's no question about that. He's as like, I'm pretty sure he bleeds orange. Like, so if he doesn't win, it won't be that like, well, why did we even sell out? I could see it being a bit softer, a bit more like, we tried our best, guys, and it didn't work again. Which,
yeah, the NDP's no stranger to.
Exactly. So ultimately, it's still down to a coin flip at this point, and we'll have to see on Tuesday night when we're getting drunk at Jaeger's how it all turns out.
Moving on to our next segment, it's all about the board-ins. We got fundraising numbers out this week, and they tell some interesting stories about both the Conservative and NDP leadership races. So Maxime Bernier led the Conservatives in terms of fundraising with a total of just over $1 million raised in the first 3 months of 2017. And he has eked out the recently departed Kevin O'Leary.
Departed not being dead, but just quit the race. But politically, he's dead now.
Yes, I also believe he has departed Canada, too, back to his home in the States.
What's interesting in this comparison of the two of them raising both about $1 million is Bernier funds came from about 4,700 people, whereas O'Leary actually had 7,300 donors, almost twice as many, which suggests almost a broader range of support to draw upon. Not that 7,000 will win you the race, but if you have the right number of voters in the right spots, it'll make a huge difference.
If it's a roughly equivalent conversion ratio across the board, yeah, it does kind of indicate where the support is. But, yeah, it's one of those things that kind of hints at where things are, but, you know, without knowing postal codes of where all these donors are from, it's a little harder to get a good idea of what that means for the actual race, or knowing their second choice.
But both O'Leary and Bernier were well ahead of anyone else in the race. Kelly Leach was third with just over $500,000 from 2,800 contributions. Aaron O'Toole and Andrew Scheer both had about $400,000. Scheer from 2,000 people to O'Toole's 1,500. And then everyone else below that was raised under 300,000. Michael Chong leading them with $284,000 from just over 1,000 contributors. Although Pierre Lemieux, who's generally polling in pretty much one of the last places, did raise $237,000 from over 2,000 contributors. I guess railing against political correctness has an audience of 2,150 people.
That was actually the one that surprised me the most out of this, because he was always kind of one of the also-rans of the campaign, and not an MP, that just doesn't have a huge amount going for him. But yeah, it's actually surprising he's done that well and beat out Lisa Raitt, who had a surprisingly lackluster campaign through the whole thing. Remember when the race first got underway, she was considered one of the stronger contenders. And yeah, it just hasn't shown through, because she pulled in just over $200,000 from less than 1,000 contributors.
Well, even Brad Trost pulled in almost 900 contributors, only $120,000 from them, but that's still 891 people going for the most socially conservative candidate that the conservatives could find.
And coming in at the bottom was Deepak O'Brien, one of our favorites, mostly because he has some really great debate moments. And he got just over $13,000 from 43 contributors.
All this data basically points to what was a two-way race before one of them stepped out. But the rest is sort of divided enough that it's not clear still that Bernier can run away with it, unless he can sort of sweep up a big chunk of those O'Leary supporters and maybe pick off the second choices of a few other major candidates. But right now, Kelly Leach, sadly, is the only one in a position to really challenge Maxime Bernier
for first place votes. But Kelly Leach has had the problem that she's very polarizing and is going to get a bunch of first choice votes and then not many seconds. And actually, that was part of Kevin O'Leary's problem, too. So yeah, it does indicate kind of where the peak support is for first choice voters. But, you know, in terms of what that means when the runoffs start to happen, who knows? And especially because we don't have a good geographic breakdown, which is really key in figuring out where the conservative race is going. I mean, I think we can basically rule out Deepak on this one. But other than that, it's a little harder to get a good idea of where things are going and, you know, who's going to go first. O'Toole is a little interesting because one or two fundraising cycles ago, he was kind of pretty middle of the pack, not really worth noting. And he is kind of edging out Scheer as the compromise candidate and climbing up that way. And so he definitely kind of has the momentum going for him, whether or not it's actually going to make a difference in the end. But I expect to see kind of him in, you know, the last three going into the final runoff. Just one other thing to mention on the momentum side. Bernier, Leach, O'Toole, Scheer, Chong, Lemieux, definitely, and Raitt have all seen their fundraising increase compared to the previous quarter's reporting, where the rest saw their fundraising decrease. So it does also kind of indicate who's lacking in there. And, you know, you mentioned Lemieux was really noticeable, but Brad Trost has lost ground on the fundraising too. And the rest are a bunch of also-rans. But yeah, it does definitely indicate where things are going.
On the other side of the opposition aisle, the numbers for the NDP race sort of give us our first hint, maybe, at who's taking an early lead on this. We don't have any polling data on this, and there are fewer NDP members than there are even Conservative members. But what it looks like first is that Charlie Angus is sort of taking that initial place in the front with $110,000 from 794 contributors. He's actually raised over 40% of all of the money of the first four leadership contenders, because Gorilla Pat is not yet officially, I think, recognized by the NDP as a running candidate and hasn't released any fundraising data.
And yeah, he wouldn't have had much time to fundraise anyway before the last quarter's reporting was due.
But what's more interesting to me is Nikki Ashton, who ran in the previous leadership election, but is still sort of seen as the fringe far left, not likely to win this time, is in second place, having raised $65,000 from just under 500 contributors, which is sort of a respectable initial base of support. It's nowhere near where Charlie Angus is, but it does put her ahead narrowly in terms of dollar amounts of Guy Caron, who has about $57,000 in the bank, but he only had about 231 contributors, so about half as many. Peter Julian, to round it out, our own BC MP in the race, only managed to raise $19,000 this quarter from just under 200 contributors, but he was in earlier, so he did manage to put $32,000 in the bank before the end of last year. But he's still behind, even with that combined total, even Guy Caron. So despite that early announcement and some like bold policy suggestions from Peter Julian, he hasn't managed to generate the excitement of Guy Caron and his basic income, or Nikki Ashton and her eco-feminist social justice campaign.
You've got anti-neoliberal in there and like five other buzzwords, but yeah, more or less.
But it's sort of, I guess, Charlie Angus's ex-punk rocker, well, also playing the more middling candidate. He's sort of sidled up on with Rachel Notley, who's now being sort of seen to the right side of the NDP because of her position on pipelines, which is sort of the Alberta
requirement. Yeah, well, all politics is local, so that's not a surprise there. But
I know within the NDP circles, there's a lot of sort of, why is Charlie Angus sort of going down that path? Why doesn't he stick to his environmental cred? You got to play all those different angles, I guess. And with the Alberta NDP being sort of the only NDP government in the country, there are a lot of members there now, I imagine, and you need those votes because the NDP race, unlike the Conservative one, is just wherever there are members, their votes are the same.
Yeah, and you know, you also probably want to be able to pull in some talent too. And the last thing you want is the Premier of Alberta saying none of her staffers can help you out on your campaign too. Nikki Ashton was definitely the surprise here. I'm not super tight in the NDP circles or follow it particularly closely, but based on what I have seen and like watching the debates and stuff, that yeah, I'm not surprised that Charlie Angus is doing well, and you know, Guy Caron's sort of pretty respectable too, and how he's doing with the fundraising. But yeah, the real one that surprised me was Nikki Ashton. I was expecting her to be third or fourth in terms of fundraising on this one.
Well, and Peter Julian's sort of failure almost with numbers this low relative, I actually wouldn't be too surprised if he backed out before the vote actually kicks off and maybe throws his hat one way or the other.
Yeah, I could kind of see that. It's my impression of him as a candidate. It's been pretty lackluster. He doesn't really sell the enthusiasm on that and his campaign at all. And you know, it's that old adage that conservatives fall in line and liberals fall in love. And you know, I think that's even more true for the NDP. And Peter Julian just hasn't given them a lot to love.
I think he had like the ideas, but when I watched the one debate I did, he felt sort of like someone's dad trying to sell them to. And you're like, yeah, he seems like a nice guy, but and his ideas seem like good NDP ideas, but you're not Jack Layton. And I think the only one of these candidates who feels like Jack Layton, if that's what they're trying to go for, is Charlie Angus, just from that down-to-earth, but maybe even like on overdrive, relatable attempts. But it's authentic.
Yeah, and we'll just have to see once the rebel guerrilla gets involved.
Well, and finally, we should say we're pulling most of this data secondhand through Eric Grenier's analysis on CBC. We'll link to that in the show notes. He links into some of the federal political party fundraising data that showed the Conservatives actually raised more in the first quarter than the Liberals. The Conservative Party raised $5.3 million from 42,000 individuals, whereas the Liberals only raised $2.8 million from 32,000 individuals in the same quarter. The New Democrats, meanwhile, only raised about $1 million from 13,000. The Conservatives and NDP could actually explain low fundraising numbers because they could talk about leadership races, and the NDP could talk about an election in BC sort of tying up all their donors' money. So this is really good news for the Conservatives, who I think have just been pushing hard on Cash for Access and another number of other scandals. The Liberals have sort of come out recently and said, oh, well, we weren't actually trying for the first couple months because they've been bringing in new rules around Cash for Access, and we've only just seen in this last week them have their first couple fundraisers under the new rules. Like today, Justin Trudeau was at a Cash for Access fundraiser, but the media was there, so it became a big event for everyone. But it's the sort of excuse of like, oh, we didn't want to win anyway, of the Liberals that always rings a little hollow.
Yeah, it does definitely ring a bit hollow on that. And you know, the Liberals haven't been able to perfect the regular small contribution machine that the Conservatives have very successfully employed, which is probably why they're still being able to bring in, you know, good amounts of money when they're having leadership contestants pulling away a bunch of that, is because they can, you know, get those like $10, $15 return donations that the Liberals haven't been able to get in quite such numbers. One other thing to note is that when you make a donation to the leadership campaigns for the Conservative Party, they all go through the central party apparatus, and they take a little bit off the top too. So like all of those big dollar amounts that the Conservatives leadership contestants were raising, bit of that's going to the party too. So that'll help pad the party's total take. But yeah, I do agree. It's not like a good sign for a ruling party halfway through a mandate not to be able to raise an equivalent amount of funds to their opposition. Because generally there's a incumbency advantage when it comes to fundraising. So maybe the Liberals are being legit here when they scaled back some of their other fundraising efforts, but it would be a worrying sign if there were other factors involved.
I also wouldn't be surprised if a lot of soft Liberal donors got churned off after things like the broken promise on electoral reform and if some of the other baggage that built up over the last year, and they're just going, well, I'm just going to hold my money for now and see how things look in 6 months because they don't need it right now. I think a lot of sort of soft supporters will just open their wallets when it comes to the election and in the meantime just sort of hold on to it.
Although there were those five by-elections that happened in the last quarter, so you would expect to see some fundraising activity coming out of those elections too. I know the Conservatives hammered that point hard, and it would not have surprised me if the Liberals had done the same thing.
Well, let's close off with some quick takes. First up, Saskatchewan Premier Brad Wall has said he's going to use the notwithstanding clause to overrule the Saskatchewan Court of Queen's Bench. What basically happened is this ruling came through that said Saskatchewan's practice, which dates back to Saskatchewan and Alberta joining Confederation, of equally funding public and Catholic schools, that's still constitutional. But what's been happening is more and more non-Catholic students have been going into these Catholic schools, both in Alberta and in Saskatchewan, and to some extent in Ontario, where this also happens. The court has ruled that this is unconstitutional, even though the school is protected. And it comes down to this narrow argument of the schools themselves were set up for Catholic students, and that is protected. But if a non-Catholic goes there, then the government funding a Catholic school to educate a non-Catholic is religious privilege and violates the other sections of the charter that aren't exempted by the narrow bit there. Very neat legal argument, and I really enjoy it from my professional work with the Humanist Association. This relates to sort of one little town that decided to join a Catholic school rather than lose their school when the public system was planning to close it down. But this reverberates across the entire province because, for example, I know the Edmonton Catholic School Board says it has about 25% of its students are not Catholic. So if that number is true for all of the Catholic schools in Saskatchewan, that's a lot of students that would have to be moved to public schools or new schools to be built. It just basically throws the whole Saskatchewan education system upside down because of just how much it's atrophied. And so Brad Wall decided, no, I like school choice, and he's just going to notwithstanding clause this ruling, which is sort of like the fifth time it's ever been used. Mostly it gets used by Quebec to exempt its language laws.
Yeah, I did not expect that I would see the notwithstanding clause used for basically anything. I definitely didn't expect it would be used for a school funding issue of all things.
Especially at a lowest court ruling. Like, this can go to the Saskatchewan Court of Appeal, which he still hasn't said he'd appeal it to, and then it could go to the Supreme Court of Canada. I think he's potentially worried that if it goes to the Supreme Court of Canada and it rules the same, that this will essentially demolish a big chunk of Catholic school funding in Alberta, Saskatchewan, and Ontario. But it's still pretty surprising.
Yeah, like, one would expect that you'd want to draw out the legal case while this is all getting done. And I imagine you'd probably delay the implementation of the ruling just because there is such a major logistical problem going forward while the appeal is set out. Like, there would be significant hardships involved for all those students now displaced, having your own new schools. Like, it would seem to me a decent chance you'd get that. And Brad Wall can draw it out for a couple of years with all the litigations going on and everything, rather than jump into the nuclear option.
Well, this case dates back 10 years already, and this is just to get through the first case. So you're absolutely right, that would draw it out. The ruling itself gives the province until next June, so just till the end of next school year, to bring it in, which both feels like a long time, but we also saw with the assisted dying legislation how slow that is to move through. And this would involve a lot of schools changing hands. So what I would have actually almost expected is, well, I'm going to bring in the notwithstanding clause to buy us 5 years, and then we will comply after that. But Bradwell's not making that argument. He's just, I never want to deal with this, so let's just leave things the way they are, and parents can have choice, which is just sort of playing to the religious base in Saskatchewan. But this will be a really interesting ruling to sort of follow. I know a lot of people in Alberta who are looking at their Catholic schools there, and there have been a lot of controversies in the Edmonton Catholic School District that I don't have time to get into here, but it makes people start to go, well, if that ruling isn't appealed, it sort of stands, and that doesn't mean it applies to Alberta, but Alberta courts could now point at that and start to use those arguments. It puts a lot of question marks on Catholic school funding in this country.
As someone who grew up in BC that doesn't have a Catholic school system, this whole thing seems really bizarre, but yeah, it's just one of those weird little bits of historical holdover that's now causing problems and resulting in the notwithstanding clause being used. So Canada's badass defense minister may be a little less badass than initially advertised. So Minister Harjit Sajjan has gotten himself in a bit of trouble for embellishing his role in Op Medusa, the 2006 combat operation in Afghanistan. During a speech on April 18th, he referred to himself as the architect of the operation and basically played up his role way above what was actually happened on the ground. People on tour with him at the time and who were involved in planning the operation have come out and said, yeah, he was involved, he did some intelligence work on it, but he wasn't part of the actual operational planning of it, and as a result, he's kind of taken a lot of heat for it, and this does not look good on him. He's taken a lot of heat in the House of Commons during question period over it. There was the Sajjan Battles hashtag that was trending, mocking it. This is not going to play well with the troops either, and you know that might actually be the biggest damage out of it, because generally, members of CF take pretty dim view of people kind of claiming credit for stuff they haven't earned.
Both the opposition leaders, Rona Ambrose and Tom Mulcair, have called for his resignation, and it's been fireworks over this, and I just can't get myself as, like, agitated or even, like, care. Like, I get that he embellished and he shouldn't have, but it's also such an ear. Maybe I'm just like desensitized to bullshit now. It feels like details relative to just like he was there. Like, this isn't a Trump level of alternative fact. So the like level of outrage to me, I can understand it. And I think you're right that the probably biggest damage is within the military of, come on, guy, don't do that. But is it something he should quit over? I'm not sure.
Yeah, I don't think this quite rises to the level of resignation worthy, but it's definitely not a good look for him on this. And there have been ministers of defense before that have not been well respected by the troops. Just the sort of thing that happens every now and then. And things have more or less gone on fine because the chief defense staff, everyone, you know, at NDHQ is pretty professional and can handle things regardless of whether or not people like the minister. But yeah, it's not going to play well with the troops. I think it's going to cause some more tension there. And it's not a good thing right before the government's going to be releasing its big kind of review of the Canadian forces and, you know, the future of the military. And if the budget's any indication, pushing a whole bunch of much needed investment and support way off into the future. And, you know, it's just kind of one more hit on the defense file that I think is going to not play well at all. I think it'll hurt the ability of him to run the department a bit, but, you know, not cripple it by any means. And, you know, things could continue on. But yeah, it's definitely going to take a lot to, I think, kind of recover that trust and respect within D&D and the CF. But in terms of the broader political thing, yeah, it's probably one of those things you weather out. I just can't see it really gaining enough long-term traction on to bring it up to the point of a resignation, unless, you know, turns out some other part of his resume was falsified. But based on what's here, yeah, I think the government's probably just going to weather this one out and be one of those scandals that's going to be forgotten in a year's time.
Well, one person who should resign and stop trying to weather it out, perhaps, is Senator Don Meredith. And I don't want us to get into all of the terrible details of the allegations and findings of various ethics reports and Huffington Post investigations, but we'll link to some of the material in the show notes. But what's notable here is that the Senate Ethics Committee, the one that was basically created after all of the scandals over the past, let's say, history, to try to clean things up and improve the image. And to be fair to the Senate, it was starting to reform itself and look a lot better. But then this news that this senator had sex with an underage girl and has harassed and abused a number of his staff have all come out.
That former allegation has kind of been around for a while and been, you know, percolating through the Senate controversy kind of in the background. But yeah, reached kind of the forefront in the last couple months, you know, when the Senate Ethics Committee's investigated, his lawyer went on TV and said, there's nothing here. This is just racism that's prompting all of these calls for resignation.
Well, I think that was Meredith himself and not his
I believe lawyer. Both have done okay.
So the big thing this week is that that Senate Ethics Committee has actually recommended the Senate expel him. And the Senate has never actually expelled someone. And they're not even sure if they legally or constitutionally can. Which every little bit here says he should probably just resign and get himself out of the fire. But maybe he just feels so comfortable sitting in the Senate and collecting that salary. But it's just not a good look for him or the Senate as a whole.
Yeah, I'm kind of at a loss of why he's sticking around this long. Unless he's going to be getting a Senate pension if he waits out like another week or something, it just doesn't seem to be the sort of thing you'd want to hold on to and, you know, really try and fight. It's the Senate. Like, it's not like there's a big political career someone's given up by leaving the Senate. So the city of Vancouver has banned an all but named natural gas from new construction projects, which has caused some controversy in the city here. So the city, which is unique in that it actually has its own municipal level building code, has put in new energy efficiency and emission standards for new construction, which, while they don't ban natural gas, are basically so restrictive that they don't permit natural gas to be used in a way that can comply with the requirements, which has caused some controversy and pushback against it from various development groups and other, you know, industry people as well. But yeah, there's concerns that this is going to be, you know, yet another costly bit of working around the regulations and making sure everything's compliant with the extra requirements the city of Vancouver specifically puts on construction compared to other municipalities.
This is Vancouver's attempt to go sort of greenest city or even carbon neutral, emissions free as fast as we can. And so cutting natural gas, which is a fairly low emissions fuel relative to some others, seems like a harsh target to go after. But at the same time, I can see a lot of buildings that are going up. A condo building that I'm buying into in Burnaby is being built without natural gas lines. There's no natural gas fireplace in it. They're all electric appliances, and it'll probably be electric baseboard heating. So it's entirely possible to build without natural gas. The bigger thing, as you sort of mentioned and allude to, is the commercial kitchens that need big stoves and ovens that typically run on natural gas. And it looks like there's sort of some exemptions in there, and they're going to try and work around to make sure that can come in. To call this a all-out ban is false. It's not. It's the sort of let's move towards using less natural gas and try to phase it out, which is popular enough here in Vancouver. It's a pretty environmentally minded city in that way. But at the same time, it's also something that I think really annoys a lot of people outside Vancouver who just point fingers and wag fingers down at us. And this is where you get the BC Liberals saying they would amend the Vancouver Charter to take away this ability if they get reelected, because apparently we've misused our privilege here in Vancouver.
Yeah, it's an oddly top-down interfering in local affairs move from the BC Liberals if they weren't, you know, trying to build a natural gas industry and don't want their biggest city to loot to not be a customer of it. But yeah, generally they've taken a fairly hands-off approach on a lot of this stuff, more or less letting cities do what their own thing, you know, unless they want to raise money for transit. But yeah, this just is one of those things that I suppose might win Liberal votes outside of the metro area, but in the city of Vancouver, yeah, I can't really see it being a big moment of controversy or swinging the election one way or the other, although I'm sure Greg Robertson is happy he has yet another thing to fight against the provincial government on and, you know, stand up to those, you know, terrible people in Victoria, as he wants to do.
Well, and finally, let's close the show with a quote from the Shaughnessy Heights Property Owners Association. Shaughnessy Heights is the sort of wealthiest neighborhood of Vancouver, where the giant mansions that sort of sprawl over large tracts of land all exist. And in their newsletter this week, they talk about the, quote, right to live in Vancouver, or at least Mick Ball, one of their writers, does. And for some reason, this went out into the public and is now here for me to read to you. Mick writes, the, quote, right to live in this city is a myth, but Vancouver's political leaders are clinging to it tenaciously, no matter what the impact is on livability. So far, just general opinion. That priority has been discarded, and the results put one in mind of the, quote, dense pack strategy of the early 18th century slavers, wherein they struck upon the idea of stacking their human cargo like cordwood in the hopes of increasing profits. The result was an increase in mortality that did exactly the opposite of what was intended.
So, wow, like, that is not the thing you should be using as an analogy basically ever, especially when it comes to a bunch of NIMBYs being all NIMBY against, you know, any sort of development. And it's Shaughnessy, like you mentioned, it's big-ass mansions and huge homes. And, like, it is not a dense neighborhood. Like, if add in a few more laneway houses, which is really what's being talked about here, and maybe a couple apartment buildings on the main arterial roads through there, if that is unlivable density, like, it's just insane. And plus, there's actually a whole bunch of studies that indicate that dense walkable communities are actually healthier, but that's clearly beside the point because apparently apartment dwellers are like slaves, I think? Is that the analogy he's going for?
And I guess that makes the residents of Shaughnessy a neighborhood, I'll remind you, which has had in the past covenants on the property that have prohibited Chinese or other people of color from buying property there. The slave owners in this analogy, well, Mick isn't the chair of the Shaughnessy Property Owners Association. He is on the board as it says at the masthead of that newsletter. But I have to presume someone edits this newsletter before it goes out. And maybe they're a very pro-free speech crowd and are happy to let anything go that they want. But it's not a good look in a sort of borderline class war kind of inequality situation to make such obviously racialized and problematic analogies. There is a Black Lives Matter Vancouver, but you don't even need them to respond to this because it's so blatantly racist.
Yeah, I'm just at a loss on how the hell anyone thought that was a good idea. Everyone would be like, ugh, that's a little much. Like, Ezra Levant would say, guys, you maybe need to tone it down a bit with this one. Like, that is just how insane and outrageous and over the top that sort of language is. But, you know, those sorts of local politics things can get surprisingly nasty at times, and apparently gentle density is just this huge touchstone for part of the city. And that has been Politkos. Following links to the stories we mentioned in the show notes at politkos.ca. Make sure to subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts and follow us on Facebook and Twitter at PolitkosPod. Leave us a review and let us know what you think. And if you have any ideas for the show, feel free to send it to us. Thanks for listening.